Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNRadio.com/Behind the Badge.
Minutes past 11 o'clock in the world's greatest city. I'm Phil Menicki and for Dave Plyer once again tonight on 720 WGN. Second week in a row. Dave Plyer, Wally Pipp. Now, hold on. I'm not saying I'm Lou Gehrig here. Take it easy. But this is the second week in a row. Dave, you've got nothing to worry about, my friend. Trust me. For those who may not know the story, Wally Pipp was the Yankees' first baseman in 1925. He got to the ballpark on June 2nd of that year. He asked the Yankees' trainer for a couple aspirins because he had a headache. His headaches got started, by the way, when he was hit in the head with a hockey puck when he was young. That's a true story. The Yankee manager, Miller Huggins, saw this whole aspirin thing, told Pipp to take the day off. He replaced him with Lou Gehrig at first base. Gehrig went on to play 2,130 consecutive games. But there's more to the story. Wally Pipp was actually born in Chicago. He scouted Lou Gehrig, who was playing college ball at Columbia University. Pipp wanted the Yankees to sign Gehrig. He also helped Lou Gehrig develop as a major league player. So use that at tomorrow's barbecue. Once again, Dave, there is nothing to worry about. Trust me, you have nothing to worry about here, okay? It's great to be with you again tonight. It's great to see so many responses to the pack a cooler reminder from last week. Thank you for that. It works, right? I kind of know what I'm doing with that. I'm just saying. All right, we got a lot of ground to cover tonight. Just like last week, I'm going to do what you guys are probably doing right now, just hanging out with some friends, some of which you'll know, some you won't. We're going to have conversations about baseball and hockey opening up. We're also going to hear from a Chicago radio icon, some comedy from one of Chicago's own. And you're going to hear a story about Howard Cosell that you have never heard before. I want to get started tonight with a tip of the cap to my friend and colleague, Bob Stroud. Bob was nominated yesterday to be in the Radio Hall of Fame, an honor so well deserved. As I said on Facebook yesterday, Bob makes all of us who try to do what he does so well every day by keeping the bar as high as he does. I saw Bob every day for 7 years when I followed him on the radio and I did afternoons on the drive. And he made me better every single day. And I love Bob Stroud for that. I have to share one of my favorite Bob Stroud stories with you. The story starts with a phone call. It's from Dave Benson. Dave was the music director at WMET while Bob was doing production, producing commercials, hosting Rock and Roll Roots on Sundays. The two are good friends to this day, by the way. So Dave calls Bob. It was right around midnight, I believe. He wakes him up and says, "Get dressed and meet me out in front of your place in 5 minutes. We're going out." Bob asks a question or two. Dave said, "I cannot tell you why or where. Just get ready in 5 minutes. I'm on my way." Dave takes Bob Stroud to the Park West, where Mick Jagger and Ronnie Wood of the Rolling Stones are tending bar. The Stones just did the last show of their Tattoo You tour at the Rosemont Horizon earlier that night. They wanted to blow off some steam. There is an actual picture of them behind the bar that exists to prove it. So, good luck, Bob. The Radio Hall of Fame is right here in Chicago, as you probably know. Chicago's Museum of Broadcast Communications, 360 North State Street by the House of Blues in Marina City. Bob is nominated in the active, local, regional 10 years or more category. He's up against jocks from New York City, Boston, and Washington, D.C. This will all be decided on by the voting participant panel, which is comprised of 600 industry professionals. The results to be announced August 17th. And due to COVID-19 health and safety concerns, the 2020 induction ceremony is going to be a live radio broadcast from multiple locations this October. Once again, congratulations and all the best to our good friend Bob Stroud on getting into a place where he so deserves to be the Radio Hall of Fame. We couldn't be prouder of you. Some stories to comment on tonight. Starting on Sunday, which is the 25th anniversary of the 1995 heat wave. You may remember this. It started July 12th, 1995. More than 700 people died in Chicago over 5 days as temperatures were over 100 degrees each of those days, which is 20 degrees above normal. The heat index, how it feels when you add in the humidity, it felt like 126 degrees. Now, this year, it's expected that we're going to have temperatures 5 to 10 degrees above normal, 50-50 chance of above average temperatures for the next couple weeks. This according to the Weather Service's Climate Prediction Center forecast. Tom Skilling says, we're okay until Tuesday when we hit 93. Looks like 89 on Wednesday, 90 Thursday, 95 on Friday. So no hundreds to worry about. Just in case, to prevent heat-related illnesses, limit your exposure to direct sunlight while outdoors. Hydrate often. Only exercise outside when it's not hot, like early morning or after sunset. Keep your car running when you're in it. Check on your neighbors as well. A COVID-19-related story in the news as well. The University of Illinois will be offering saliva-based COVID-19 tests at the Urbana-Champaign campus. This test is easier when the test that you have to take a deep swab into your nose. So that's a good thing, right? And you're also supposed to get results within 24 hours. All you got to do is drool into a test tube. And if you've ever been to CAMS on a Friday or Saturday night, you know all about that. When I was there, it was Boney's, by the way. I helped close that place down. Boney's. C.O. Daniels, the White Horse, maybe T-Birds, Murphy's. That's where we played High Bob. The goal is to conduct 10,000 tests per day at more than a dozen campus sites by August 24th when in-person classes resume. This according to Brian Casella of the Chicago Tribune. All right, off my soapbox. It's a something for everyone program tonight. We're going to talk sports, both Blackhawks and White Sox. We're going to hear from one of Chicago's own comedians. We're also going to hear a Howard Cosell story that I guarantee you never heard before. And up next, we're going to get started with a conversation with a true Chicago radio legend. He's one of the reasons I'm here today, in fact. Phil Minnickin for Dave Plyer, 720 WGN. Phil Minnickin for Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. 18 minutes past 11 o'clock. Our first guest tonight is a Chicago radio legend. He's entertained us on just about every station in town, except for this one, actually. And he's been fired by all of them as well, some more than once. Please welcome to 720 WGN, Mitch Michaels. Mitch, thank you for joining us, my friend.
Oh, hey, Phil, great to be with you. I appreciate you asking me, and yes, I have. And I have not been thrown off of WGN, at least not yet.
Well, but, you know, we'll see how this goes. You've never worked for GN, but you have been a guest, right? To talk about your book.
I was on with Wendy and Bill about 2.5 years ago when my book came out.
Got it. Don't jump the gun on that. We're going to get to the book. Take it easy, okay?
Okay. No.
So we'll start from the beginning. Where did it all start for you? You were born in Cleveland, right?
Born in Cleveland, right. And was interested in radio. Was going to college, but came back from a rather unsuccessful midterm. And this really did happen. A commercial comes out, and the guy goes, "Do you hate what you're doing? Did you just flunk a test?" And I'm like, and it was actually a ad for a radio school, and so I pursued that, checked it out, talked my parents into letting me take a semester off and go to this radio school, which was in Washington D.C. I was going to Kent State University in Ohio, and you know, went there, did that, loved it, got a job while I was there. But the deal I made with my dad was that I would go back to school after graduating from the radio school, and I did. Worked at the college station, got a job in Cleveland, and just progressed from there. Came to Chicago in December of 1971.
There you go. And when you were in Cleveland, it was WMMS, right?
I worked at WGAR and then WNCR, and then I worked at WMMS, too. Yeah.
Legendary calls there. So you get to Chicago. Where do you start here in Chicago?
WGLD 102.7, the Oak Park Arms Hotel in the fifth floor of Oak Park. Amazing, amazing place. Every time, you know, I had hair down to the middle of my back, and they had a security guard in there. Great big old guy was missing a couple of teeth in the front. And you take the elevator up four floors, and then you had to walk up the last flight to the radio station on top of this senior center, old folks' home.
Wow.
This guy came up in the elevator with me every night. Every night.
Very cool.
So it's like, yeah.
After that, you went to XRT, right?
I did. I went to XRT for the summer, the fall, and into the winter of 72. And that's when it was midnight to 6, 7 nights a week. And this guy, Don Bridges, called me and said, hey, you know, do you want to do a couple nights a week so I can have some time off? And so I did Saturday and Sunday nights, midnight to 6. And then I was working at a record store the other days. And that's how I learned how to get around Chicago. This guy had me out hawking records to all the other record stores. And so I drove all over town and gained a little bit of knowledge as far as, you know, where things were, what towns were. I still never could figure out the northwest suburbs because the streets don't go north and south and east and west. They wind around and they change every time you go to a different suburb.
The name changes.
So it's like wait a minute. Wasn't I just on Main Street? Now this is, Sunset. What happened?
Preaching to the choir, my friend. You're preaching to the choir.
You got it.
I'm a Southside boy, and they're all straight except for Archer Avenue. You're fine.
There you go.
Right?
There you go.
Right. All right. Mm-hmm. So, do we want to start counting the times you got fired or not? Do we
if you must, we don't have
to do it. But I'm just
let's see. I got fired from WGLD. Then I quit XRT to go to DAI, and then I got fired from DAI and went back to XRT. And then I got fired from XRT and went back to DAI for a minute and then went to WKQX and was there for about 2.5 years. And I got fired from there and then went to The Loop and was there almost 3 years. And I got fired from there. And let's see, then I was I thought I was going to be an actor, so I decided to try my hand at acting and freelance and voice work and stuff like that. But got back on the radio a couple of years later and then went to WCKG in 1987, was there for about 6.5 years, got fired from there. And then I went to WLS as the production director, worked there for about 4 years, and I got fired from there. So it's like, you know, I changed my deodorant, changed my socks, but, I don't know.
That's 7, by the way, if you're counting at home. I'm just saying.
I think there's a couple more in there, but, I don't know.
7 of note. Okay, that's good. Currently, you do afternoons on WERV, The River.
Right, 95.9 The River, out in Aurora.
Very cool.
Yeah, longest job I've ever had. Been with the company, knock on wood, 10 years this coming January, and I've been at the River 9 years this coming September. So it's,
congratulations, my friend. That's quite the feat.
It still blows my mind, but I'm having fun still. You know how that goes.
Oh, yeah. In this business, that long? Really? Yeah, that's cool. I have to tell you, I alluded to this in the open, that you are one of the reasons I'm here. And I think I've told you this story. This is at Chicago Fest when it was on Navy Pier. Okay.
Right.
Crocus is the band that you introduced.
Okay.
Okay. You're standing on the stage watching the show. You got jeans, you got a white t-shirt, you got sunglasses on the side of the stage. You got your arms folded like you own the place. And I said, I want to do that. I want to be as cool as Mitch Michaels.
Boy, yeah. I really, let me apologize right now.
Well, You're a huge influence for me, along with some classics in Chicago. John Records Landecker, Stephen Gary, Bob Surratt, Sky Daniels, Bob Stroud. You heard the story?
Bob Stroud. And by the way, let me throw in a quick congrats to Bob as well. I've certainly sent him some notes on this, but so well-deserved and such an entertaining and bright and articulate guy. I couldn't be happier for him. Well-deserved.
The knowledge that he has is just incredible. And you know, you can get knowledge nowadays. You can go to Wikipedia. There's thousands and thousands of sources, but this guy was there, and he knows all of this stuff. And
oh, I know.
And
I
as
know.
I said, he made me better every day because he was just so good. And
well, I've often said that I'm the smartest and most in-depth guy on the radio, as long as the computer's on and the internet's running. Yeah, it's like so.
It's easy to do, my friend. It's easy to do. Let's talk about the summer of 79.
Sure.
Kind of a big one for the Loop here in Chicago.
Well, it was, you know, I mean, the whole thing from the beginning, when we went on the air in March of 79, it was just, it was like a whirlwind. Okay, and I mean the advertising with Lorelei and the commercials on TV. You had just an extraordinary staff with Steve Dahl in the morning. They paired Gary Meyer with him, and then Les Tracy middays. I was on in the afternoons 2 to 6. Sky Daniels was on after that, and it was, you know, the station just took the city by storm, and we were playing great rock and roll, but we were playing some new stuff too. You know, I mean, nobody was really thinking about the Talking Heads or, the Pretenders or some of that other kind of stuff that just didn't seem like it was the same venue, the same genre. But, man, people just gobbled it up, And I give Sky Daniels a lot of credit over the period of time, because he was a guy that really, really knew the music and fought for music to be played on the radio. He was a guy that knew it, wanted it, and was willing to lay down for it, so to speak. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And he had some of the best ears in the business, right?
He really did. Absolutely. Yeah. And an articulate guy like you, I mean, wow. To know Sky is to know what a wild and crazy guy he was back in those days. But, man, at the same time, he was very deep and very, very, for lack of a better word, well-spoken. He could string some words together.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And he followed you. And, that time slot right there, both of them, was like, man.
It was pretty dynamic. It was pretty much a lot of fun. But you know, that whole summer, you know, we had Chicago Fest down at Navy Pier, like, as you were talking about, and that was so insane. The black T-shirts were everywhere with the lipstick logo of the Loop, and then of course, and actually, the 41st anniversary is Sunday, Disco Demolition.
All right, hold on 1 second. I got to take a break here. We're going to hear about Disco Demolition, the rest of the summer of 79, and the rest. It's Mitch Michaels with us, Phil Minicky in for Dave Plyer, 720 WGN. Phil Minicky in for Dave Plyer, 720 WGN, 1131. We're talking with Mitch Michaels, Chicago radio legend. Again, thanks for joining us, Mitch.
Hey, my pleasure. But, you know, easy with this legend thing. I always thought you had to be dead to be a legend. Let's make it the alleged legend, all right?
The alleged. Okay. I'll include that for the rest of the evening here. Back to the summer of 79. The Loop is flying high. Disco Demolition happens.
Yeah. Disco Demolition happens. And you know, I've told the story of so many times. Dave Logan came up with this idea for Dahl, and they took it down to like Point East down south and did a thing down there, and it went pretty well, and they had a pretty full house down there, and the White Sox were not a good team, And Jeff Schwartz, I think, went to Mike Vec and said, "Hey, you know, what do you think? And let's try this. Maybe put some fannies in the seats." We had a meeting the day of Disco Demolition at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon in Les Elias's office. The general manager, it was he, Jesse Bullitt, the program director, Dave Logan, the promotion director, Jeff Schwartz, myself, and Mike Vec. And we each wrote a number on the blackboard of how many people we thought were going to show up that night, okay? And Dahl was petrified. He really thought it was going to be a bomb, and he was going to be really embarrassed. And I think the biggest number on the blackboard was 28,000, okay? And we thought if we did 28,000, this would be just unbelievable. Well, you know, we get to the ballpark, and I do a couple innings of play-by-play with Harry Carey and Jimmy Pearsall, which was one of my bucket list things anyway. I was just thrilled to death to be able to do that, you know. And, you know, as the first game is progressing, I mean, the park is really starting to fill up, you know. And it's like, wow, what's going on? It was a day-night doubleheader, you know. And, man, oh, man, oh, man, we get to the end of the first game and we get ready to do this this whole actual disco demolition. And they used all the records that people brought to get in because it was 98 cents in a disco record. That's how you got in. And there was wall-to-wall people everywhere. And you looked out of the park, and there was just a huge throng of people outside as well, you know. I mean, I don't know what old Comiskey held back in those days, 40 to maybe hanging from the rafters, 45,000, okay?
Right.
And there had to be another 25,000 to 40,000 people outside the ballpark that didn't get tickets, couldn't get in, were being turned away, and, you know, what it was like, you know. So we proceed with the demolition. Steve and Gary and Lorelei are driven out on the field in a Jeep. And, you know, Steve's got his army fatigues on, and they're doing some stuff out there and Yahoo and whatever else. And you got to remember, the White Sox were the first team to ever use pyrotechnics for entertainment with, you know, home runs and stuff like that. They were the very first in it.
The exploding scoreboard.
Exactly.
Sure.
Yeah, exactly. Dovet. The original showman of baseball. So, you know, we figured these guys could blow up these records real good, you know, and they did. So they had this thing in a huge, like a mesh dumpster out in right center field, and they explode this thing, and it just blows up unbelievably. And it actually caught part of the field on fire, okay?
Oh, boy.
I don't think, honestly, if nobody had gone on the field, I think they might have had trouble playing the game anyway, because there was a big chunk of the right center field that was just, you know, it just wasn't there anymore. It's like, you know, right down to the pavement, so to speak. But then most people that wanted to get crazy were jumping out of the stands and going out on the field, and all of a sudden you had, you know, 6,000 or 8,000 or 9,000 people out running around on the field, and it was complete chaos, total chaos.
Yeah.
But I was in one of the big booths upstairs. And Mike Vec comes to me and he goes, "Hey, can you come back and get in the public address and see if we can get these guys off the field?" And we tried to do that. And, you know,
how'd that work out?
Well, you know, I don't know. It looked like we were having a little bit of momentum. Back to your seats, like you do at a concert or something, you know. And all of a sudden, Harry, who'd been in the bars room, I think, comes up and goes, "What the hell's going on?" You know, and he comes up and takes the mic from me and starts singing "Take Me Out to the Ball Game," and, you know, and I think by that time it was a done deal anyway. But you know, and Harry Carey was always one of my heroes, so Harry could do no wrong as far as I was concerned. But
Jimmy was equally, maybe even more upset with the whole thing.
Jimmy was asking me, he says, "Who are these people? Why are they here? What's going on? What is this?" I said, "Jimmy, these are sports rockers. They love sports. They love rock, and they're here to have some fun. You know, it's like
that's funny.
Yeah,
you said this was in your book the best time of your life in radio.
Well, it was just such an amazing time because we just had one event after another, and I mean, I've never been anywhere where you did so many things so quickly. I mean, that was July 12th was Disco Demolition. You had Chicago Fest going on, and we were down there in a big and very presence way. Well, then the 5th of August, we had the Loops Day in the Park at Comiskey Park. We had five bands. We had Santana, Journey, Thin Lizzy, Eddie Money, and Molly Hatchet. And we had 60,000 people for that show. Nice. And I remember being told, because I was emceeing the show, don't say anything about Disco Demolition. Don't say anything. But, you know, I said, okay. So I go out on the stage.
So how did you handle that? I love this part.
I go out there and I go, hey, how you guys doing? Look at, we're back here already. And they're letting us on the field this time. They love us. And the crowd went crazy. I caught a little grief for that afterwards, but it was like, you know, it was worth it. It was like,
there was a memo about that, wasn't there?
There was a lot of memos. Trust me. It was like, I remember the next day, I think the Disco Demolition was on a Thursday night. And there was to be no mention at all of anything whatsoever. Nothing.
Right.
On the air the next day. It was
right.
Like it didn't happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, okay. All right.
I remember Greg Salk. You know Greg.
He was
an intern at the time.
Right.
And his parents were at home and they saw this going on TV because it was all over the TV.
Oh, God, yes.
Greg goes home and they say, you are never working for that man again.
Yeah.
He goes, what do you know? I'm getting changed. I got to go in. We got to do a broadcast. So there you go.
Yeah.
Now,
right.
Now that summer, the Loops ratings were nuts.
We went in three books. We went, spring book was 3.5. We went to 5.5 and then to 7.3.
That's
in three books. And we beat WLS straight up 12 plus. No FM station even come close to doing that.
Right.
And it was, it was just amazing. You know,
yeah. Unheard.
I mean, it really was, and we continued to do stuff. Okay, as we got towards fall and things were kind of progressing. The numbers had come out. And we were so huge, and we started talking to Celebration Flipside about a Who show that was going to come up in December. And we wanted to try something different, something new, something that nobody had ever done before. And so we set up 9 Chicagoland theaters with full concert sound and satellite hookups. And we wanted to broadcast the Who show. We have the Who on board and Celebration Flipside. And about a week before the show, it wasn't going. We only had sold like 4,000 or 5,000 tickets out of 25,000 seats in these theaters. Okay. Cause the Who show was sold out at the amphitheater. So, the general manager, Les Elias and Jeff Schwartz, and I went to Detroit and sat with Bill Kirbyshley, the manager of the Who, and with Townsend and, I got Townsend to talk about some stuff and whatever else, and then I called Matt Bisbee and said, be at the station at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. I'm coming back and we're going to produce a promo. And we promoed the promo all day, and at 3 o'clock we came on with this promo. And I wish I could play it for you right here, right now. It still gives me chills, but it starts out with, this is Pete Townsend. We love your city. We don't know where we are at the moment. We can't wait to get to effing Chicago, and we just barely bleeped that out, you know. And that was that promo ran, and the phones went crazy, and we cut a few more promos, and we sold around 20,000 tickets in like 5 days.
Sweet. Very sweet. I got about 1 minute left. I want to talk about your book, Doing the Cruise. This is not a coloring book, Mitch. This is 411 pages long.
Well, you know, if you're a reader, you'll like it. Everybody that's read it told me that it was a good read. So, it's just a book about my life in general, but in particular in the radio business, and some interesting stories, some fun stories, and some personal stories. And I'm glad I did it. It was a lot of fun. Ken Chirilla was a huge help. The guy that really did the writing for it, even though I sat and told him all the stories. And the one thing we had to do was teach him how to write Mitch speak, so it sounded like me. Cool. And he did a great job. So
very cool. A great read. You should definitely get it. Doing the Cruise by Mitch Michaels. Mitch, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it. What did I say? How am I supposed to outro you? Not radio legend, but a legend?
A legend.
Yeah, radio right. Legend. Mitch, thank you so much. Coming up next, it's the Howard Cosell story that you have never heard before. 720 WGN.
Spanning the globe to bring you the constant variety of sport, the thrill of victory, and the agony of defeat. The human drama of athletic competition. This is ABC's Wide World of Sports. Brought to you by Lincoln Mercury.
Phil Minicchia for Dave Plyer at 720 WGN. I love that. It's 11:47. Joining us from Ireland, he's authored 15 books, was a radio and television presenter for decades. He's covered 5 Olympic Games, starting with Munich in 1972. It's Mr. Liam Nolan. Liam, thank you for joining us.
It's a great pleasure, Phil. And hearing you saying 1972 there, it was like something in the mind. Somebody had pressed a fast forward, and something came back from the fast forward. And I think one of the people that I met there at that particular Olympics, I mean, that was the one that was disfigured by the terrorist attack on the Olympic Village. I'm sure you remember reading about it, if you can't actually remember back to it.
What was that like?
Well, the terrible thing about that Olympics, and that the dreadful thing about it, was the fact that 11 Israeli athletes died in it. And in a sense, the thing almost came to a full stop. But if Lord Kilmainham, an Irishman who happened at that time to be president of the International Olympic Committee, himself and the rest of the directors decided that the best thing actually was to go ahead with it. That caused shock, naturally enough, and there were people who were against the idea of the games carrying on in the face of the tragedy. But of course, the other side, the balancing consideration was that if they stopped, that would mean giving in to terrorists.
Got it. What were your thoughts on that?
I was very sobered by it. I was frightened at one stage, actually, when I was there as a commentator, as you probably know, and a radio commentator, and I was asked if I would go out once the terrorists had actually broken into the village and had come into the Israeli part of it. And I was asked if I could go out onto an embankment looking across at the village and fairly close to where the terrorists were actually out on the balconies as lookouts. And I was carrying a stick mic with me. And it occurred to me as I went belly forth up the embankment that holding a stick mic looked at from 25 yards away as if it would have been the barrel of a gun.
Oh,
and that made me very, it brought me very close to destroying my underclothes. I don't mind that. One great memory that I have of those particular games was meeting an American icon.
You're referring to Mr. Howard Cosell.
The icon was Howard Cosell. And the way I met him was, at that particular time, the games, by the way, there was a lovely, lovely man who was the presenter of Wide World of Sport on ABC television in America. And he was there, and he eventually ended up as the host of the games. And that was Jim McKay, whose real name was McManus, an absolute gentleman and a very, very talented broadcaster. But I was there as a boxing commentator, and I was commentating for the BBC. And our commentary booth was in the boxing hall. And if you wanted to talk to a boxer once he had been involved in the competition, you went down to what was known as the international area. And they didn't normally come out immediately because they would go and have a shower or whatever. So I was looking at a competition between an American boxer, Ray Seals, a light welterweight, who was tall for a light welterweight. He was over 6 feet tall. And a very gentle and lovable man he was, and he stayed that way for the rest of his life, as far as I know. But he was boxing in the second round of the competition. Not the second round of a bout now, but the second round of the competition. And it so happened that the boxer he beat for him to go on to the next round was an Irish lad from Belfast. His name was, most of us would call it Montague, but for some reason or other, he was known in Ireland as Jim Montague. And when Seals got the decision over him, the producer in tonight's hands said, you know, I think, Liam, it would be a great idea to get an interview with Jim Montague if you can. It will have a big appeal, quite clearly, in Northern Ireland. It will appeal to listeners in England and Scotland and Wales, and presumably in the Republic of Ireland as well. So if you nip down and try and get him when he comes out, and we will cover here, he said, by crossing over to the show jumping arena. So I went off down anyway, and I got first place in the queue right at the exit from the boxing arena itself. And about 15 minutes later, this tall, ugly, hunched figure in an appalling yellow blazer pushed its way to the head of the now small queue behind me and pushed me aside. Now, excuse me, I said to him, I was here first, and I've been waiting for the last quarter of an hour. And in a high staccato voice with strong Brooklyn twang to it, and by the way, I don't really do accents, he said to me, this is for television. Now, out of my way. And he tried to push me aside. So I pushed him back, and I said, no, you get out of my way. And he said, this is for ABC television. ABC television from the United States of America. And I said, I don't give a goddamn if you're from XYZ television from out of Mongolia. He said, do you know who I am? I said, sadly, I have that misfortune. I said, your name is Howard Cohen, but you changed it to Cosell for some reason. You wear a toupee, and I can see the joint from where I am. And I said, you're a professional loudmouth and a pain in the ass. And Dick Young and New York News calls you Howie the Fraud. Well, I thought that he was going to have a cardiac arrest. He pulled himself together and he said, listen here, young man. I said, don't call me young man. I'm an author and a journalist, an editor and a broadcaster. And he said, my audience is a voluminous one that extends right across the United States of America. Now, who do you broadcast for? I said, I happen to work for the biggest and the most prestigious broadcasting organization in the world, and its audience extends right across the world, and where ABC's audience probably amounts to a few tens of millions, the BBC's audience at the Olympic Games like this is over 600 million. Now, next question. He said, you seem to know quite a bit about me. Now, how has that eventuality arisen? There you go again, I said. Always trying to use the $15 or $20 words, the polysyllabic words. The reason I know quite a bit about you, Mr. Cohen Cosell, is because I'm what you are not. I'm a professional. By the way, I'm not as stupid as you look. Well, he nearly swallowed his cigar when I said this. And then he said, you are the very soul of egregious impertinence. I'll keep on talking. I said, someday you'll say something intelligent. Now, get out of my place in the queue, I said. BBC may have bought the American TV rights to the games. $7.5 million, I understand, that you paid for them. But you seem to be deluding yourself into thinking that they bought the entire Olympic Games. Well, they didn't buy the entire Olympic Games. And you can get back there now and stand with your cameraman, your sound man, your assistant producer, and whoever else is there waiting. And if one of you tries to push me slightly out of the way, I can guarantee you that there is somebody with me or up in the booth with me that will destroy you. Now, what do you mean, and who are you talking about? I said, I'm talking about a British boxer who actually downed Muhammad Ali when he was still Cassius Clay, hit him with the left hook and almost stopped his career for him. And I said, you put a finger near me and tried to push me back, and you would tear not only the tooth hair off your head, but probably the head off your shoulders. He coughed and stressed it, dropped his cigar, bent to pick it up, nearly fell over, and the toupee went sideways. And that was shot. Somebody came back from the crew, and they said, they actually called him Mr. Cosell. And they said, look, we can wait for Mr. Seals. And I said, yeah, you wait for Mr. Seals, and I hope that he is better mannered than you are. And one of these days, I said, perhaps you would become not the most disliked commentator or sports personality on American television. You may get somebody who will have some sort of affection, which I presume your mother had for you. Now, I said, I wish you a very good night, as my brother-in-law would say, may you go with you, and now may you travel abroad and procreate. And that was the end. He moved back. He knew what I was getting at, and he came as near as he ever could come to an apology. He was a quite extraordinary character.
What a great story.
Well, you know, I mean, the man is dead now a long time, but he went through his life suffering from a particular disease, and that was diarrhea of the mouth. you know, any real similarity between Howard and a proper commentator or a proper journalist, in other words, he hated journalists and was detested by them, but any similarity between him and them was absolutely coincidental. And the difference between him and Jim McKay, and by the way, he was very, very insulting towards McKay behind McKay's back. He used to refer to him as the diminutive one, which was an awful insult to a man who was a gentleman to his fingertips. But the way he talked, the way he would break up syllables, the way he would use a word that, like antidote, he'd call it antidote, or say, I'm a terribly, terribly bright man. And of course, the extraordinary admission that he made when he stood in front of the microphone on one occasion, and he said, I've been called arrogant, pompous, obnoxious, vain, cruel, verbose, a show-off. And there's no question that I'm all of those things.
Mr. Liam Nolan, the Howard Cosell story you've never heard before. Thank you for sharing. Joining us next, if you've ever been to a Chicago Blackhawk game at the old Chicago Stadium, it's a familiar voice. That's after top stories from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on 720 WGN.
come the hops, the mighty Black Hops. Take the attack, yeah, and we'll back you, Black Hops. You're flying high now, so let's wrap it up. Let's go, you hops, move up. Now all the hops, here come the hops. Here comes the hops, here comes the hops, here comes the hops, here comes the hops. Here they come.
Phil Minicky for Dave Plyer, 9 minutes past midnight. Welcome to July 11th, 2020 in the world's greatest city. Woo-hoo. Our next guest was the public address announcer at both the Old Chicago Stadium and the United Center for 41 years. And I know no one misses hockey as much as Harvey Wittenberg. Harvey, thank you for joining us at 720 WGN.
My pleasure, Phil. Hockey is back. We're going to get to that in just a little bit. First, where did it start for you? You were born in Chicago, right?
I'm a hometown boy, outside of the University of Illinois in Champaign. I've lived in Chicago all my life. So.
You went to your first Hawks game when you were 10 years old?
10 years old, the Stanley Cup playoffs, the Hawks against Montreal, 1946. And I saw the likes of the Bentley brothers, Doug and Max, and Billy Mozienko, and played for Montreal in that 1946 playoffs, which a lot of the players hadn't been back from World War II yet. Billy Ray was playing on the line with the same Rocket Richard. So I fell in love with the game. I didn't know the rules then or anything, or the players, and after that I became a lifelong fan.
Absolutely. 41 years as the PA announcer, what was that like? Oh my goodness.
So it was kind of interesting in the old stadium. The fellow I succeeded, Bob Foster, who worked at WGN, WGN opened the Washington Bureau, and Bob was tied in with politics, so he got transferred to Washington, D.C., and I was his backup guy because I was involved with radio in Chicago. So,
got it. Kind of like me and Dave Plyer.
Yeah.
He decided to take a couple weeks off, and hey, you know, this could be a Lou Gehrig situation, just like you. Yeah, so you went to the University of Illinois, my alma mater as well.
Yes, and major in radio, TV, journalism.
And what was more important for you then, the radio part or the journalism part?
Well, like I say, when I always had a lifelong dream when I graduated grade school on Chicago's West Side. I wanted to be either a sports announcer or a sports writer. So I fulfilled my dream. I exceeded my dream.
Absolutely. All right. So hockey is back. Thank goodness for this. Some dates. July 13th, the start of formal training camps. The Hawks are already doing voluntary stuff now, right?
Yeah, they're getting in shape. One thing about hockey is that even when regular season, besides all that's going on in the world, hockey is the only sport I know where the players are supposed to report in game condition to training camp.
Right.
And what happens, there's the only sport I know that within a week of training camp, they start the first games. I mean, the preseason games, but they start right away.
Right, right. So July 13th is the formal start of training camps. July 26th, the clubs travel to hub cities. Those hub cities, Chicago was in the running at one point for this, right?
Right at the end, yeah. The four cities that got down to it right at the end, Chicago and Vegas in the States, and Toronto and Edmonton were the two cities in Canada.
And they decided on Edmonton and Toronto, correct?
Yeah, because it avoids going back and forth between the states. Like I said, the Eastern teams played in Toronto and the Western teams played in either Vegas or Chicago. They'd have to eventually go across back the border. So the Canadian government waived the fact that there'd be restrictions going back and forth, but the league decided it'd be easier that way because of the geographics.
Got it. And that kind of makes sense, I guess, right?
Yeah.
And then the next date, August 1st, the start of the qualifying rounds. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, the Hawks are in the playoffs.
Yeah.
Wow. Realistically, what do you think our chances are? We play Edmonton in the qualifying round, correct?
Yeah, Edmonton, you know, is a talented team. They, Leonard Dreisel and Connor McDavid, I mean, two great hockey players, and Dreisel won the scoring record of the regular season. So The fact that there will be no crowd in the stands may detract a little bit from Edmonton playing on their home ice. But, you know, in the playoffs, anything can happen. So the home ice doesn't mean that much because both teams have them up. So the first round of the qualifying teams on the side of the top four, they play a best of five, and the rest of the all series are best of seven. So if the Hawks get by Edmonton, they play the next highest seed team because the Hawks would have the lowest seed going into after the first play-in round. So.
Got it. A lot of times in the playoffs, it comes down to a hot goalie.
Right.
Is Corey Crawford that guy?
Well, he certainly performed well in the playoffs, and he had a really solid season up until the suspension of play in March. So, but of course, a goalie is only as good as the guys in front of him. And the defense has to rise up, and we're getting Dion back after his shoulder surgery. He's eligible. So, and you got veterans, like Keith and those guys. So it should be good. But you got to stop the scoring, and you got to stay out of the penalty box because Edmonton is with Dreisel and McDavid are terrors when it comes to the power play.
Right, right. You touched on it a little bit earlier, just the fact that there's no fans in the stands.
Yeah.
That's going to make a huge difference.
Oh, yeah. It can swing a game one way or the other and gets the adrenaline running on the players. So, from that standpoint, the Hawks and Edmonds will be even from that standpoint. Although playing in their home rink, where the bounces go off the backboards and stuff like that. So it gives a little bit of an edge, but not much.
Right. And honestly, with nobody in the stands, you're going to hear a lot of stuff that you normally don't hear from the players. And the language could get a little dicey, because it usually does.
Oh, the days before they had the mics and all the TV stuff and everything, originally when I did the PA back in the old stadium, I was in between the penalty box with the official scorer. And when the players came over, after calls were made, there was some unsavory language that might go bouncing around.
That's going to be interesting as well. We're talking with Harvey Wittenberg of the Chicago Blackhawks. More with Harvey in just a little bit. We're going to talk about, among other things, Hall of Famers, a couple of books that you've done, and more. Harvey Wittenberg, more with him next for 720 WGN. So, Nicky and Dave Fire, 720 WGN. We're talking with Harvey Wittenberg, PA announcer for the Hawks for 41 years. Still part of the team, correct?
Yep, I'll be starting my 62nd season with the team. So,
wow, that's amazing. The Blackhawks have two new Hall of Famers, Marian Hossa and Doug Wilson.
Two great players. I didn't realize until he got elected that he had been passed over several times, but Hossa, this is the first year he became eligible. His statistics, are phenomenal. And, of course, what he did with the Hawks, being on three Stanley Cup teams, is phenomenal. And a player that plays both ends of the ice. I mean, he's always been top five in the league in takeaways, taking the puck away from other players on the other team. And he played penalty kill, and he played power play. And, of course, when the Hawks won their first cup in 49 years in 2010, we were playing Nashville in game five at the United Center.
Oh,
and
that game.
Hossa gets a major penalty, didn't get thrown out of the game, gets a major five-minute penalty, like a minute and 10 to go in regulation, and the Hawks are down by a goal.
Yep.
And with 13.5 seconds, Kane shorthanded scores to tie the game. But then we go into overtime, and you got almost 4.5 minutes left in the, or around 4 minutes, I think 7 seconds was it officially, left in Hossa's penalty. And Hossa comes out of the penalty box in 15 seconds, he scores the winning goal. We go down to Nashville, leading the series 3-2 instead of being down one and possibly getting eliminated in Nashville and go on to win our first cup in 49ers.
That game was amazing, and one of the many reasons Marian Hossa is in the Hall of Fame. Like you said, one of the best two-end players ever.
Yeah.
Why do you think it took Doug Wilson so long to get in?
Well, you know, every year the committee evaluates things, and, you know, his name is on the list, although he holds the Hawk record for goals in the season 39. He was the second to last player with the Hawks to play without a helmet. Al Secord was the last one that played for the Hawks without a helmet. But when he came back with the Hawks later, he did wear a helmet. So Doug was a phenomenal player both ends of the ice. And, of course, he's been general manager for San Jose and has done a good job at that, although they haven't won a cup. They've come close. Although when the Hawks won in 2010, they finished a point ahead of us in the regular season, and then we swept them in the conference finals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But Doug is an excellent, good player.
Absolutely. And a great guy, too, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm just going to read this statement, and I'd like to hear what you think about it. This is from Wednesday's Tribune article by Paul Sullivan.
Mm-hmm.
The subject is sports organizations and their nicknames.
Mm-hmm.
The Hawks preemptively released a statement Tuesday night saying they don't want to change because, quoting here, the name and logo symbolizes an important and historic person, Blackhawk of Illinois' Sac and Fox Nation, whose leadership and life has inspired generations of Native Americans, veterans, and the public. We recognize there is a fine line between respect and disrespect, it said, and we commend other teams for their willingness to engage in that conversation. Moving forward, we are committed to raising the bar even higher to expand awareness of Blackhawk and the important contributions of all Native American people. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, this controversy has been going around the country. High school teams that had nicknames that, Chief Illini, it's a fine line, but I think the Blackhawks have always honored the name. Of course, Major McLaughlin, who got the franchise in 1926, the Blackhawks in the NHL, he was the major in the World War I infantry, and his group was called the Blackhawks. So he was named after, the Blackhawks were named after that, but of course it recognized Chief Blackhawk from Illinois. So the Blackhawks have always honored it, and in recent years when they, before the anthem, the war veterans that have been American Native Indians have always been part of that honor. And, you know, it's not any disrespect on the Indian nation, the American Natives. So I think it's right that the Blackhawks maintain honoring it and respecting it, and it should remain the same.
I couldn't agree with you more. That's a great situation that the Blackhawks were proactive in it instead of waiting for whatever to happen. So
yeah.
I think that's good news. I agree with you on that as well. So the book. Actually, there were two books, Tales from the Blackhawks Locker Room, a collection of the greatest Blackhawks stories ever told. You wrote the first book in what year?
2003, and then they updated it in 2011 to include the Stanley Cup of 2010, and then updated it again in almost came out in 2017, which was updated in the next two Stanley Cups of 2013 and 2015. So the original book was just updated and added to, and then the other edition back in 2017 was the same. So everything that was, there are a few minor changes that updated things in the book, guys that have passed away and honoring name and stuff like that. So if someone buys the book, it have all the original information, 2003, and then on and so forth. When the book first came out, and I think it was on page 3. I did an extensive interview with Keith Magazine. He complimented me on the book, and then unfortunately 10 days after that, he was killed in that auto crash up near Windsor, Canada. So, it's stories of the players, the coaches, officials, broadcasters, sports writers, and in their own words, and just added to everything. So, I was caught up with a lot of players I hadn't caught up with, and then nice conversation with the guys who were living out of town, and unfortunately, a lot of the guys have passed away. I know when I first wrote the book, I did a campaign to have Pierre Plas' jersey retired, and it was. My next goal was to get Steve Larmer's jersey retired, so his record stands for themselves, and a great hockey player, a really good guy.
I hope you're successful with that as well. But as you said, lots of great stories. The book is an easy, easy read because there are rather short, just anecdotes and stories that are all hysterical. Do you have any favorite stories?
Well, of course, one of the favorites was Chris Chelios when he was playing with the Hawks. And they were up in Montreal, and Keenan had a curfew. When the players were on the road, he had a curfew, okay?
I love
so that. So they're staying at the hotel in Montreal, and I think they were listening to country music. So, and they had a game next day with Montreal. So the time got away from them, and it was like midnight, and they're going back to the hotel. I think the curfew was 11. Anyway, they're walking into the lobby to go to the elevator and go up to their rooms, and then the elevator door opens. Who walks out? Mike Keenan. So Keenan looked at them and didn't say a word, and they got in the elevator, and Keenan got out of the elevator. So they, next day is a pregame practice, which is usually around 11 or noon. Both Steve Smith and Kelly were saying themselves, wondering what's going to happen with Keenan, because he's kind of a strict disciplinarian. Anyway, Keenan didn't say anything. So the game starts, and they're wondering what's going to go happening here. So Keenan starts Steve Smith and Chelios in the game. And usually on the shifts, defensemen usually skate for about a minute, minute five, where forwards do about 40, 45-second shifts. So, you know, the minute goes by or whatever, and Smith and Chelios head to the bench. Keenan points to them. He kept them on the ice the entire first period.
And nothing was ever said, right?
Right.
But they kind of got the message, though, didn't they?
Oh yeah. That's you know, in the early days, the Hawks were pranksters a lot. You know, when the guys were on the road or kidding around. I remember one instance with Pat Stapleton, who just unfortunately passed away a few months ago. It was during the playoffs at the old stadium, and the guys were kind of, you know, finished the practice and everything. Johnny Morris, who played the wideout for the Bears, so they're outside talking, and Morris is a pretty fast guy. So, and Stapleton was ever known for his speed. So Stapleton said to Morris, running down the side of Warren Avenue, the north side of the building, the old stadium, Stapleton said, "I'll race you down the block for a case of beer." So Morris, you know, Morris takes off his jacket, you know, and loosening his shirt and everything, and he's lining up. It was in, I think it was late April anyway, and so if anything, it was Cliff Coral was calling off, "Get ready, on your mark, get set, go." Morris takes off down the block, and Stapleton just takes a few steps. And Morris is running down the block. He turns around, and he said, "Where were you?" He said, "Well, I didn't tell you I beat you. I said, I raised you for a case of beer." You know, he takes a beer.
Did he ever get that case of beer?
I don't know.
Very, very funny. Great stories. You've got to get this book if you're a hockey fan. It's a definite must. Tales from the Blackhawks Locker Room. A collection of the greatest Blackhawks stories.
Yeah, the stories still go all the way back from, I added some things in the early 30s, interviewed some people, it was great, and then we just added on to it. So it's anybody who is a hockey fan or a Blackhawks fan will enjoy reading. I hope to do another edition when we win our next cup.
The always optimistic Harvey Wittenberg. Keeping with the sports theme, it's the Chicago White Sox player with the coolest team record ever. It's a record that no one will ever break, and we're going to hear from him next. Phil Menekin for Dave Plyer, 720 WGN.
White Sox, go, go, White Sox. Let's go, go, go.
Phil Minnicki for Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. It's 1233. Our next guest was a 1983 American League Rookie of the Year. He's a fan favorite, Ron Kittle. Ron, welcome to the program.
My pleasure. And, you know, a whole lot of things going on nowadays in the country, so I got time to chit-chat with you.
Yes, we do, and I'm glad you're doing it. Thank you so much. Let's talk a little bit about the 1983 team. Oh, my goodness. Are you kidding me?
You know, it was early part. It was the start of my career, and I was just fortunate enough to be on a pretty good team with some great players and tremendous coaching staff. We won a lot of ball games, but it between the lines, it was business, and we had fun afterwards too, which is really a special combination for a team.
Absolutely. All right, just a few names on that team. The manager was Tony La Russa. You had Harold Baines. You had Carlton Fisk. You had Greg Luzinski. You had a 40-year-old Jerry Koosman. Wow.
Which and Jerry was probably the most pivotal part of the team because he became not only a pitcher, he became a mentor for all the young pitching staff, Lamar Hoy, Rich Dotson, Floyd Bannister. And he knew just as much about hitting because he played, it was kind of sad, he played with some of the best hitters in the game of baseball. So there was constant talk of baseball all the time. We had Julio Cruz, Ruby Law, I mean, Bethel. We had a nice combination of players that just all blended well, and it was fun to go to the ballpark.
The winning ugly team, you were the rookie of the year that year. You were also an all-star. These numbers are impressive. 35 home runs, 100 RBIs, a club record for a rookie, 35 home runs, by the way. Wow. Incredible.
Well, you know, it's already been broken. Jose Abreu did it. He beat me on the last day of the season. He played 158 games. I played 140. So, you know, it's just a record. The records are made to be broken.
There you go.
But back then, there was probably only four or five people who had 100 RBIs that season. I you know, I'm not picking on the talent of today, but back then they had three or four good starters and a couple relievers on every team. So, you know, your ability to get RBIs is a little bit harder back then than it is now. Just once you knock the starter out, I mean, it's open field. But it's still baseball. A lot of great memories, made a lot of friends in the game, and I still keep in touch with, I would say, probably 80% of the players I play with.
That's cool. I think the coolest record of all, the coolest part of your resume, you hit 7 home runs on the roof at Old Comiskey, more than any other player.
Well, you know, it's kind of special. I didn't think nothing of it. I hit one during the tryout with the White Sox, but Babe Ruth was the first. I was the last one. Greg Luzinski hit 3, and it's kind of funny because they did a marketing campaign when he hit his 3rd one on the roof. With Halo advertising in that game, I hit one on the roof to tie him at 3, so they canceled the whole campaign and he was screaming at me. But so you had to hit it 550 to get it to the roof, you know, due to the height and the length. And so, I came up with a cigar brand called Ron Kittle Rooftop Cigars, and inside that box, and you buy it for charity, and it has a name of all the players who ever hit it on the roof. Jimmy Fox hit 6. But I never saw Jimmy Fox at 6. And they said he was stocky, but he was, just built like a brick. And and it has a list of all the players who hit it. So I think there was 31 players that hit it on the roof X amount of time. So it's a nice record.
Yeah, and it's the coolest record, and it makes you just that much more cool, I think. I don't know.
Well, I've never been cool, but, it is pretty phenomenal. I mean, I've hit baseballs farther than probably anybody who's ever played the game, even farther than the Mickey Mantle home runs and all that. But, I wish I would have stayed healthy through my career. You know, I came in the game with the Dodgers, broke my neck. I was out for 2 years, got a second chance, and, things change. Never stayed healthy for a full season except my rookie year, and it's. But I had a blast in the big leagues, and I met some great people.
Very cool. The new 60-game schedule was released Monday for Major League Baseball. The Sox home opener is July 24th against the Twins, 7-10, Guaranteed Rate Field. Be there or be square. There's 40 games against the American League Central teams, 20 games against the National League Central teams. What do you think about that?
It's kind of weird, but Major League Baseball has been a staple of sports entertainment through the world for years. Apple pie, Chevrolet, you know, hot dog, popcorn, whatever it is. We need to do something positive because there's really not a whole lot of positive things going on in this country. You know, a few guys on each team have tested positive for it. You know, they're checking for fevers. I mean, there's games I played in the big leagues with probably 103 degree temperature fever. I played, got sick for a couple of days. You know, it felt better. I don't know nothing about it. I really think I had this virus possibly in January. I caught it for 6 weeks straight. Never could get rid of it. Can't remember if I had a fever or felt bad. I tell everybody, last time I felt good, I was 12 years old playing outside. I don't really know. But it's baseball. You got to go out there. There's probably, you know, more fans are saying you've got an asterisk on everything. I mean, everybody wants to put an asterisk on something. Go out, play some games. Let people enjoy a little bit of entertainment and see what happens.
Love the attitude. Speaking of entertainment, the August 13th Field of Dreams game against the Cardinals with the White Sox, that's going to be really cool.
Yeah, you know, that is it's certainly kind of special. I was looking forward for the Yankee series before all this craziness happened. I was going to buy a couple Harley Davidson and have them custom painted for the Field of Dreams and have each team autograph them and use it for an auction item, raise money for charities. But that's with another plane in St. Louis. Am I going to be there? I have no idea. I know the tickets are hard to come by. There's only 8,000 seats. I don't even know if they're going to allow fans there. But nobody knows. And I kind of was one of the original partners in the Field of Dreams project down there. So I might have a little bit more better in than some people. But
you know a guy.
I know a guy who knows a guy. But it's kind of fun. But it's going to be, you got to walk through the corn stalks to get over there to the field to play it. It'll be all screened off like everything. And it's going to be limited, but nobody really knows the exact extent what can happen there. Right?
Right. Stay tuned for that. We're talking with White Sox legend Ron Tittle here on 720 WGN. It was announced yesterday that the Sox are going to use Boomer's Stadium in Schaumburg for their taxi squad. That's a stadium you know a little bit about.
Yeah, you know, I managed up there for a couple of years. It's a nice ballpark, and it's, what, 45 miles into Sox Park. You got to stay close by. I'm sure Roger Bossert and the crew is going out there right now to make sure the stadium's, you know, perfectly filled and manicured and groomed for the players. But I like that rule where you got to have somebody. So the Cubs have South Bend, which is privately owned over there. But, yeah, I haven't been back to the Schaumburg Flyers or Boomer Stadium since I left. It's fun baseball. I had a great opportunity, won a couple championships there. But I just don't want to get back into the minor leagues again. But, you know, it's close enough to follow and keep people close by if somebody needs, somebody gets hurt.
Right.
You know, these players nowadays are all in shape. I mean, they make enough money to have health clubs at their house, work out, do everything. If they're not in shape, that's their fault. That's not the organization's fault. But I think we need to start playing some baseball and see what happens.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Let's talk just a little bit about the book, Tales from the White Sox Dugout, a collection of the greatest White Sox stories ever told. Did you have fun doing that?
You know, I started a book, and it was called You Got to Be F***ing Me. You can delete it if you want to. That was the title. It's really funny stories through the minor leagues and the big leagues. Then the White Sox approached me, and they said, we want you to do a book, Tales from the White Sox Dugout. Pick an author. So I had a choice of some Hall of Fame candidates. I chose Bob Logan because I know he would write it like I told him, and he did, exactly. And it came out really nice. There's things I wanted to keep out of the book that he wanted to keep in there, but it was fun. I made a comment about Barry Bonds in there. I mean, it was a true story, so you got to buy the book to read it. And, you know, the first edition, then I did an epilogue, and I added 3,000 words into it again with more pictures, so it became just a little bit better book. But it's a fun baseball read. There's no lies in it. I mean, because if you lie, you got to remember. I'm getting too old to remember lies, so you just tell it as it is. But you know as well as I do. I'm blatantly honest. If you want the answer, I'm going to give it to you. You may not like it, but you asked. And it was fun, and it was talked about my charity, the minor league, how I got signed, just life in general. And, you know, I'm having a good time in life, barring all the injuries I've had. There's days that I, you know, I told you I sleep 3-4 hours a night at the most, and it's never even continuous. A lot of things hurt, but you just got to keep on going, and that's my style.
Very good. And anyone who knows you knows that you love motorcycles. We've only got about a minute left, my producer's telling me. You had a trip planned to Canada right about now, right?
I was going to leave yesterday, and we were going to go 25 days on motorcycles from Glacier National Park up to Banff and visit all the resorts and the parks and find these little small towns. But you can't go across the border in Canada. With the hotels are still closed up, so I'm going to put this trip off till next year. But we'll take a couple little quick side trips. We might go to Sturgis this year because it's still open right now, see Mount Rushmore. But I love being on the bike. I do my best thinking for all my art designs, and I love meeting new people and some old-time great places.
Very cool. And you need to check out your store. It's called Mine, and there are so many cool things on there.
Well, you know, it's ronkittle.com, and you can hit to my charity link on there also. But I'm not taking nothing with me when I go. so I get rid of things. And 90% of the stuff that I sell personally goes in the back into my charity for making things where I can donate. And I have my charity site, too, which is going real good, ronkittlecharities.org. But it's all fun, and like I said, I'm loving life and enjoying it.
You keep doing that, Ron. Thank you so much for joining us. Ron Kittle is your funny wife, back, everybody.
Appreciate it. Talk soon.
Coming up next, it's a Chicago comedian I know we'll be hearing a lot from, and he's next. Phil Manekian for Dave Plyer, 720 WGN. Phil Manekian for Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, 1247. Our next guest has appeared on Late Night with both David Letterman and Stephen Colbert. Please welcome Chicago's own Pat McCann. Pat, thanks for joining us on 720 WGN.
Thanks, Phil. How are you, man?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Hanging in there along with everybody else. Just, you know, pushing through these days and not really getting on stage, but, you know, trying to stay busy and
things are a little different, right?
Completely different, yeah. And no show since March 12th. That was the last time. So I've been trying to. I was originally doing some pop-up shows here in my living room. That kind of ran its course. My kids got sick of me. So I'm just trying to stay busy. How are you?
Okay. I want to talk more about that in just a little bit. First of all, you're from the south side of Chicago, right?
I am, yeah. I'm from out here. I still live out here in the, like, West Beverly, they call it, Beverly Morgan Park area.
Got it. So, Southside Irish, right?
I am, yes. Yeah, used to do the March in the Parade every year growing up. And then after school, I lived up north in, like, the Ringgoville area for a while. And I came back out here when my wife and I started having kids.
Got it. So you don't have any stories about throwing up after the parade, do you?
No. Not that I can remember.
Thank you for your answer.
Not too many.
You got started late in life with comedy. Why is that?
You know, I just never really was like a stage guy or theater. Or, you know, I was just always kind of like drawn to comedy, and I'd like to write. So it was kind of like a pipe dream in the back of my head. I was like, I'd like to be like a writer. And I realized I wasn't writing things in Chicago. And, when I met my now wife, she was, you know, I kind of confided in her, like, I think I would like to try stand-up. So I started going to open mics. I did like a sales career, and, you know, probably like 30, 31. I just started doing open mics and kind of snowballed from there.
It got good to you.
I was scared. Is that what you want me to say, Phil? I was scared until I was 31.
Kind of like me doing talk radio after being a rock jock for all these years. It's kind of the same thing.
Yeah, right. It's a transition, right?
Yeah, yeah, totally. Totally. And you were doing stuff at Zany's, and you like became a regular there, right?
Yeah, I was asked to be a house MC there. They kind of had gone away from that model. And like 2008, 2009, I was invited to be the House will be there, which is an unbelievable experience for me, because Zany's, unlike a lot of comedy clubs, open 7 nights a week. And we were doing, like, you know, 14 shows a week. All of a sudden, I was getting a ton of stage time. So they were, I think, to catch up to a lot of people that have been doing it a long time. And not only the stage time, but I got to work with so many comics. And the fact that they were coming through Chicago, and I didn't have to travel, and, you know, at that time when I had, you know, we were just starting to raise a family at the end of the road during those years. So I always look back on those days as just being, like, completely invaluable for me. Sure, in terms of growth and everything, and being at a legendary place like Zany's, it's always, like, my home, you know?
And it's just like anything else. The more you do it, the better you get, obviously.
Yeah, and what they forced me to do there, which I was not doing, is like to get out of my material and talk to the crowd, because as a host, you want to welcome people, find out where they're from, and kind of ease into the show. So that was a good experience for me.
And that's a totally different thing from when you've got a routine and you've got some regular jokes that you do, right?
Oh, yeah, you got to get out of your comfort zone and just find it. It's kind of like, it's just like, you know, learning a new position in the sport, you know, you want to, you kind of get into it for one reason, and then you realize you got to have all these other tools to be a complete player, so, very cool.
Very cool. Saturday Night Live is probably the gold standard of comedy, would you not agree, right?
Oh, yeah, I mean, I was like a big SNL fan coming up, and...
Now, with this whole pandemic thing, they did some shows without the audience. Did you see any of those? What did you think of those?
I did see the one that Tom Hanks hosted, like the first one back.
Yeah.
And it looked like he was, like, not in a place that Tom Hanks would live. Did you see that?
Yeah, totally.
Like, where does this guy live? I thought he was killing it. I did watch it. And, you know, you got to, like, grade those shows on a curve, because it's so difficult to do comedy without feedback. You know, I mean, it's always hard if you're not getting laughter or playing off of the energy of the audience. But I enjoyed them, you know. It's got to be, comedy's always got to be like now, and it's got to be, I think, pretty honest and holding up a mirror to things. That's kind of where it is.
Right.
So it was better than watching a rerun, I think.
Right. But there's also the difference of not being with each other when you're performing and working off of that energy and whatever. And that was one of the biggest things that I noticed that was so different that just wasn't there. It couldn't be there because they weren't together, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. You need to have that, especially for what SNL is doing, like the sketch comedy, you know, different characters, and every sketch is like a little episode, you know?
Right, absolutely. Now, you did some TV somewhat recently with Robin and Larry on WGN TV, right? You've been kind of a regular with them.
Oh, I'll tell you, man. WGN Morning News is the chemistry on that show. And I do morning shows when I travel different cities, and, you know, you pop into these morning news shows. There's really nothing like that show in the country that's local and that has that... just their sensibilities are so fun, and they're so welcoming to me. I think they, you know, they've been really good to me because I'm from here and I still live here, and I've gotten to be friendly with all those people on the morning news. And when I go on there, it really does move the needle. Like, I pick up followers, and I get people connecting with me on social media. Like, they have such a reach. That show is awesome.
Yeah. And one of the most recent ones, you were with your wife and kids on there, too. And you were going around the house with a microphone. That was terrible, man.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I've been doing those pop-ups. Like, my kids would be watching TV, and I would just turn the TV off, interrupt them. So we try to recreate that. I woke them up that morning, and, we had some fun.
Very cool stuff. Getting back to being live again, a different situation than, you know, when you're with Robin and Larry on TV. How do you deal with hecklers when you're in a club?
You know, it's usually the hecklers are bothering everyone else just as much as they're bothering the comic. You know, there's a million ways to do it, but it usually is, first of all, like, where are they at in the room? Because they're going to bother anyone between you and where they are. So it's tough sometimes when the heckler is like right in the front row, because you'll go to bury them, and everyone else in the room is like, they're not even aware that someone being loud, or so I just usually try and, you know, turn things on them or talk to people that they're with, just embarrass them so then their friends are telling them to shut up too. And but I don't get a whole lot of hecklers. I think that you know, most of the time people are, unless you're doing like a Friday late show and people are, you know, wasted and just, you know, completely out of their minds. But it usually doesn't last too long. I can, you know, I brush up those skills that I learned as the host, you know?
So we got about 1 minute left, Pat. You've got a special coming up July 28th, right?
Yeah, July 28th. It's going to be available on iTunes. It'll be available on Amazon. And we shot it in Chicago. We shot it at the Vic in September. We had 2 sold-out shows. And we took the best of the 2 shoots, and I'm excited for people to see it. It turned out great. The Vic was really good on camera, and the energy that night was insane. And I'm anxious for people to see it.
We can't wait to see it, July 28th. Pat McCann, Chicago Zone. Thank you so much for joining us, Pat. We hope to see you on stage soon.
Thank you, Phil. I appreciate it, man.
Thanks to all our guests tonight. We started with Chicago radio legend Mitch Michaels. From Ireland, Mr. Liam Nolan. And the Howard Cosell story that you never heard before. Former Chicago Blackhawk PA announcer Harvey Wittenberg on the opening up of the NHL. Fan favorite from the Chicago White Sox, Ron Kittle. And finally, Chicago's own comedian Pat McCann. Something for everyone tonight. Special thanks to my producer this evening, Curtis Koch. Thanks for all your pre- and post-production work. Appreciate that. Also, engineer Adam Phillips. Last but not least, a big thanks to Dave Plyer for letting me fill in tonight. Dave is back next week. Do not forget about Dave's show, The Sinatra Hours, Sunday mornings from 6:30 to 9 here on 720 WGN. Hope you made you smile tonight with our conversations about the Hawks and the Sox and Disco Demolition. The 41st anniversary of Disco Demolition is Sunday. Maybe we should blow something up, right? Just a thought. I don't know. If we did make you smile, if you could let the powers be here at WGN know, I'd really appreciate that. Thanks so much for being here and for all your kind words. The Matt Bubala Show is coming up. That is after news from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. That's next here at 720 WGN.